Samuel 21, 2 Samuel in chapter number 21 is where we are at this evening. I want to say I'm thankful for all those who are involved in media and music. And one thing that encourages me regularly is to look up and see Brother Drayson dragging the median age way up on the music people. I am saying that, obviously, tongue-in-cheek, very thankful for Brother Jason, but it's pretty awesome to see people that are the next generation of the church engaged, involved, growing, and using their capabilities and their gifts, because it will matter well beyond Faith Baptist, God willing, and that's our desire, that wherever God puts them, that they're ready to step into what God has for them there to bless and be a help to a church and the gospel mission, and so glad for them as well, as our seasoned veterans like Brother Jason and Miss Laura. So 2 Samuel chapter 21 is where we are at. 2 Samuel 21, we come back to our series, God's Grace in Our Weakness, as we have looked at it last time. And the last time we were here together in 2 Samuel, we walked through the remnants of the uprising. Absalom's coup defeated. And there should have been a lesson learned there, but Sheba didn't get the memo. And so Sheba leads another failed rebellion against David. And in that passage, we saw this idea that when you want to live as a law unto yourself, well, it's going to come up to catch up with you eventually. We saw that with Joab's ruthlessness, and not only how it affected him, but infected an entire city and cost Sheba his life. And in that passage, we saw David, Joab, Amasa, Sheba, all of them with their choices against God, contrary to God. All those choices brought harm to them and then those around them as well. So what we talked about was being a law to yourself places those around you in great peril. Eventually, it may not be today, and it may not be tomorrow, but it will catch up with us eventually. Now, we come to the passage tonight, and which we're not exactly sure when it happened during David's reign chronologically. It could have happened right after this with Sheba. It could have happened at another time. It was selected to be there by the narrator. It also mentions an account with Saul and a transgression he did against a people group that's not recorded in the scriptures, but took place historically. And so with this passage, what we're going to see is Israel in a very terrible spot. They're in a terrible spot because God has intentionally afflicted the entire nation due to choices of people in the past. So they're undergoing chastisement for decisions they never made. In fact, King David has to take actions to rectify a problem that weren't of his own doing, and the decisions he had to make weren't necessarily popular or favorable or easy. And so with that idea, look at 2 Samuel 21. 14 verses is where we're at tonight as we look at this passage. And note what the author records for us. Then there was, what's the word? A famine. That's the worst word possible for people in their context. There was a famine in the days of David. How many years was it? 3 years. Year after year. And David, he did a smart thing here, inquired of the Lord. And the Lord answered, it is for Saul and for his bloody house because he slew the Gibeonites. We may not know when it chronologically happened, but we do have at least this clue. Saul's dead. Saul's gone. So we know it's post-Saul. So a dead guy has created the situation you find yourself in, David, that the nation finds itself in. He's dead, he's gone, you have the chastisement. The king called the Gibeonites and said unto them, now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites, enemies of Israel. And the children of Israel had sworn unto them and Saul and sought to slay them in his zeal to the children of Israel and Judah. Wherefore David said unto the Gibeonites, what shall I do for you? And wherewith shall I make the atonement, that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord? And the Gibeonites said unto David, we will have no silver nor gold of Saul, nor of his house, neither for us shalt thou kill any man in Israel. And David said, what ye shall say, that will I do for you. And the Gibeonites answered David, "The man that consumed us and that devised against us should that we should be destroyed from remaining in any of the coast of Israel's, here's what we want." Verse 6. "Let 7 men of his sons be delivered unto us, and we will hang them unto the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, whom the Lord did choose." The king said, "I will give them." Well, that's not a popular decision, is it? Verse 7. "But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the Lord's oath that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. But the king took the 2 sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Ahiah, whom she bare unto Saul, Armoni and Mephibosheth," this is a different Mephibosheth for clarity, "and the 5 sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul, whom she brought up to Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Mehithothite. And he delivered them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them in the hill before the Lord. And they fell all 7 together and were put to death in the days of harvest, in the first days, in the beginning of barley harvest. Rizpah, the daughter of that fellow, took sackcloth and spread it upon her on the rock for the beginning of harvest until the water dropped upon them out of the heaven and suffered neither the birds of the air to rest on them day or night, nor the beasts of the field by night. And it was told David what Rizpah had done." And now, verse 12. "And David went. He took the bones of Saul, and he took the bones of Jonathan his son from the men of Jabesh Gilead, which had stolen them from the streets of Bethshan, where the Philistines had hanged them when the Philistines had slain Saul of Gibeon. And he brought up from thence the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son, and they gathered the bones of them that were hanged. And the bones of Saul and Jonathan his son buried there in the country of Benjamin and Ziklag, in the sepulcher of Kish his father. And they performed all that the king commanded them." Now catch this, the end of verse 14. "And after that," after amends were made to the enemies of Israel, I want you to see a troubling and confusing phrase perhaps in our mind from the outset. After that, God was entreated for the land. Now, did you catch that? After he did what was needed, what was deemed right or necessary, then the Lord lifted the famine that was upon the land. Here in our passage, David acted gracious in dealing with the fallout of Israel's disobedience that had been compounded by Saul's treachery. And here's what I want you to think about tonight. We've talked about in the message titling, "Where Sin Abounds, Grace Can Much More Abound." Where sin abounds, grace can much more abound. If there's a truth to pull away, here's what it is. It's on the screen. No matter how difficult a situation has become due to people's choices, Christians can seek to do right in a gracious manner. Listen, it doesn't matter how ugly the situation is, how difficult the situation is. I doubt you and I are going to find ourselves in such an awkward or weird scenario as King David does in this passage. But you have, you will, or you're going to come across some very difficult and frustrating moments in your life that aren't of your own doing. I do a lot of counseling here in the community, and so do several people at our church. And what I'm regularly grieved and astounded by is just how complicated and convoluted something like marriage and raising a family can become. Especially when you start getting into second or third marriages and kids and this and that and X is here and X is there. Sometimes you can find yourself in a difficult situation, not that you put yourself into that, but it was maybe foisted upon you, or maybe even you chose due to what was going on in your life, whatever it is. Here's what I want us to take away from David and his example through this passage. You and I can seek to do the right thing in a gracious manner. First thought tonight is this: David sought God's aid when facing a situation he had not created in verses 1 through 4. He sought God's aid in facing this situation he had not created. In verse number one, the text shows us what's taking place, even if it doesn't tell us when it's taking place. Now, hypothetically, let's say this is after Absalom, and this is after Sheba. We could read this and say, our brother can't catch a break, can he, right? He goes right through all that, then into 3 years of famine. The uprisings are quelled, and yet now the man after God's own heart can't even catch a breather. Well, we don't know when exactly. Here's what we do know from verse 1. There is a lingering famine. Likely a lack of rain has created this inability to grow crops. Now, when I say there couldn't be much worse of a word for that culture, this is why. It's an agrarian culture. An agrarian culture where if you have no crops, you have no grain for livestock. If you don't have livestock, you may not be able to do the tilling or have the food or the milk you need. No grain for bread, no vegetables, no fruit. If you don't have rain in their culture, listen, you can have war. You could have a lot of other things, but a drought may be one of the worst matters that they could possibly have. And this wasn't 1 year's drought. You know, growing up, sometimes people would have their harvest ready with either cotton or maybe corn or something or wheat, and a hailstorm would come through in the Texas panhandle and just decimate and destroy it, and there just wouldn't be anything left. Well, you'd hear farmers complain and talk about how difficult it is going to be, a tough year. Well, this isn't year one tough year. What is this? This is 3 years running. Now, I don't want to be too over the top here, but can you imagine everybody year one? Well, you know, sometimes it's just a tough year. Year two rolls around. I mean, it's a tough year, but I've got concerns. Year three rolls around, and everybody hopefully is doing what David's doing. All right, let's hold the phone here. There's probably something going on. God, what is going on? We're year after year into this famine. Though unwritten, it seems that it is desperate times. One author put it like this: because of the Palestinians' almost total dependence on rainfall and dew for crop moisture, poor harvests were not uncommon and were not automatically considered a sign of displeasure. However, when crops went year after year, David rightly thought that this was a curse from God for some kind of disobedience as the covenant nation. Because he had promised them that, right? You bless me, you follow me in faith, you'll enjoy my blessing as a covenant nation. You don't do that, I'm going to start getting your attention. And failed crops was one of the ways he promised in Leviticus 26 and in Deuteronomy chapter number 28. So David, having no answers, goes to the right place for wisdom. He inquires of the Lord, and God gives him clarity. It's not due to anything he's done. And David had done his fair share of sinning in his reign, hadn't he, right? It's not due to him. It's due to Saul. Saul against the Gibeonites. Now, that doesn't really ring a bell for us. Obviously, David was unsure as well and had to contact them and find out what had happened. So it begs the question of you and I, who are the Gibeonites? Well, the Gibeonites are people who lived in a city that was given to the tribe of Benjamin later, Gibeon, which is about 5 miles north and west of Jerusalem. If you're looking at the map, it kind of goes up that way, a little smidge west of the Galilee there. And so this is where the people group were. Now, we don't have time to necessarily read Joshua 9, but since you're taking meticulous notes, Joshua chapter 9 is where you find the cross-reference backstory. Remember we talked about that in connection group this morning? Cross-references? Here's your chance. Joshua chapter number 9. When I give you the synopsis, you'll be like, there it is. I remember it. Who are the Gibeonites? The Gibeonites are a group of people who were already settled in the region there of Israel, what would become Israel, during Joshua's conquest. They start hearing about when and how and where Joshua is and how they are marching east to west here. So if you're looking here, they go across the Jordan and they're cruising. That orange strip up top is where the Gibeonites were at. And so as Joshua is marching westward, they know they're next. Jericho, down. Ai, down. Nobody has even been able to stop the war machine that is Joshua and Israel because of the power of their God. So what do the Gibeonites do? We got to figure out something. We're going to get wiped off the face of the earth. So they make the appearance that they're from a very, very far country, looking to come praise the God of Israel, who's a mighty God, and make a league. And though they're way far away, should they ever need anything, don't come with your chariots, don't come with your swords, don't come with fire, don't come to us as friends. So remember, they make their bread look moldy, they mess up their garments, they kind of dishevel themselves, they try to show themselves as if they've traveled such a long distance away so that they could make this treaty and honor the God of Israel. Well, Joshua and the other elders, the leadership there, they receive them. And after a few days, what do they foolishly and hastily do? They make a treaty. A peace treaty between two nations. We won't come invade you and wipe you off the map, and you will be a friend to us if the time ever arises that we need a friend to us. Oh, okay, and everybody's happy. Until Joshua finds out what? You guys are just down the road. Are you kidding me right now? You guys didn't come from a far place. You didn't come from Canton. You came from Thailand. Or, you know, that's how it was. They thought they were from forever away, and that wasn't the case. They were just a little west of their position. In verse 18 of chapter 9, the Israelites are not happy with their leadership. They complain and murmur against Joshua and the elders for what they had done. And the leaders are in a tough spot. I mean, we made a covenant. We made a covenant to our God that we would not harm or hurt these people, that they're not going to be our enemies. There's a peace treaty in place. And we did that not just to them. We did it to God. We made this commitment before our covenant-keeping God. We made a vow. We can't go back against the vow. So what do you find in the rest of Joshua 9? That they decided to place them under subjugation and tribute. They would have labor and exact tribute from them. So these enemies of God were allowed to stay in the land in the northern part there of Israel under subjugation and under tribute. Now catch this. That's the Gibeonites, okay? If Israel had just obeyed before, then the passage we're reading now would never exist. But because of the lack of discernment, and it's a rare moment for Joshua as a leader, the lack of discernment Joshua and the other leaders had in being disobedient to God and the conquest instructions that he had given very clearly. Because they were disobedient to God, it led to decades of allowing a non-Israeli enemy force to be couched right in their midst. And even though they were profitable for them at a level, they were also a source of spiritual idolatry in a pagan intermarriage situation that happened. So if they had just been discerning and obeyed, it never would have happened. But let's go further. If Saul had just obeyed, this wouldn't have happened either. Why does this now matter to David? Because Saul, though it's not recorded for us in the scripture, at some point decided he was had enough of it. And to prove his zeal for Israel as their king, to prove that he was the conqueror that God had anointed and sent, in some reason, in some way, he goes and slays the Gibeonites. We don't know when, we don't know why, we don't know how, but all we have is their recounting of it, which is what? This man came to wipe us off the face of the earth. Maybe it's exaggerative, but he was bloodthirsty. We know that from the life of Saul, don't we? And he went against the Gibeonites. He was guilty for what he had done in breaking the treaty and breaching that treaty. And now he's dead and off the scene, but the guilt still remains in God's court. So if Saul just kept his word, David would not be in this awkward spot. The nation would not be in its third year of famine, and Saul's descendants would not be facing their unwanted fate that we've already read about. In verse number 2, David seeks to honor God and restore Israel's integrity. Though they were their enemies in one sense, God still expected his people to be what? His covenant-keeping people. Joshua made a vow. They were expected to keep it. Saul may want to go wipe them off the map. He's expected to keep it. But because he didn't, this passage exists. Verse number 3, David calls the elders of the Gibeonites together, and he says to them, basically, how can we have an amendment here? How can we find a solution for both our nations? Because we've breached the covenant. We have a curse from our God. We need to know how to fix this. Verse number 4, the leaders refuse to be enriched by anything. I don't know the sense necessarily. We can't find that in the context. Is it that they're like, we would rather die than take a thin cent from the house of Saul? I don't know. I don't know if it's that strong or that powerful or that motivated in that way, but they don't want anything from Saul's house good-wise. They also make it clear they don't want David to have to execute any of his own people on their behalf. So David in verse 4 implores them again, what do we need to do to get this breach restored? Our nation has done wrong to God and done wrong to you as a people group. How can we make it right? Now, before we go any further in the text, what are we seeing? This is a matter centuries in the making. This mess just didn't spring up overnight, right? It's due to the failures of people who were in positions of leadership who were way before David with Joshua and who were right before David in the house of Saul. But faced with this ugly moment, David has a hard task in front of him, but it's an opportunity he takes to do what? Rely upon God and seek peace with other people. Is it ugly? Is it going to be tricky? Is it going to be dangerous maybe to handle with care? Yes, but let's rely on God and let's seek peace with other people. I just want to say before we go any further, when we are in a mess, no matter who made it, it does us well to seek God's help and walk humbly with those who are in the mess with us, all right? So David seeks God help with this mess he didn't even create. But secondly tonight, Saul's consequences outlive him to cause pain in the present there with David. They outlive him to cause pain in the present with David. Verses 5 through 10 outline what this pain is going to be like or what it's going to look like. And verses 5 through 6, with deliberation, the men decide to require judgments upon the house of the man who had done them so much harm, King Saul. Since Saul had sought to eliminate them as a people group, they're going to do the same to his offspring. They're going to make sure that as few descendants of Saul can remain as possible. And so they demand 7 sons. But it's appropriate we recognize it this way. It's not just 7 sons. It's 7 grown men. They're not 6 years old. They're likely not 16 years old. They are grown men, and they're requiring at least 7. Maybe there's some symbolic reason for that. We're not overly worried about that. And they're going to take these men, and they're going to publicly execute them in that town to be an example. And David does what in verse number 6? He consents. I'll do it. You need 7 of Saul's descendants, and you're going to execute them? Received. I will act upon it and grant you what you're asking for. I think it's important here that we kind of hold up and ask ourselves an apologetic question. If God, and we would agree with this, if he's pro-life womb to tomb, how can David, who's a man after God's own heart, do this in good conscience? And further, how can God allow it to be righteous or just? Now, I don't think there's easy answers here. I really don't. But I think it's important for us to think that way when we read our Bibles, especially you young folk. Think that way when you read your Bibles. Think apologetically. Though Israel had disobeyed God, they had done something. They had bound themselves with an oath before God not to harm the Gibeonites. Saul had violated that covenant and thereby sinned against them, but sinned against God. Perhaps these men were even complicit. That wouldn't be unusual for have family members in the regime. You even see that with David, with his a nephew here and a cousin there and an uncle there, everybody in the regime. So it could be that Saul's own family members had created some of the difficulties we find here in this matter. One author put it like this, though, to help us get clarity. In cases involving the unsanctioned taking of human life, the Torah called for retribution in like kind. You can see that in Exodus chapter 21, Leviticus 24, Deuteronomy 19. And even in this case, though it involved aliens, that was the word for strangers in the land, even though it involved immigrants, if you would, in the land, Leviticus 24 was very clear. So apologetically, Here's the ugly, short answer. Sin has consequences. Sin's consequences eventually catch up to us, and sin's consequences bring deep pain to all of those around us who are involved with it or were never involved with it. Recently, unfortunately, there's been another well-known Christian leader who's been caught up in a moral impropriety. And I grieve because a man who's had decades of serving the Lord, decades of ministering to pastors, decades of helping shape pastors and how they preach and teach, is now what? Out. Out because he was outed because he was not repentant. Now he's got his wife, his adult kids, his grandkids, the church he pastored, the places and seminaries he taught at, the speaking engagements that have to be canceled, all that. Because, my friends, sin has consequences, and it always goes beyond us and brings deep pain to those involved. In verses 7 through 10, David has just what I would never want. He has a task to select the seven. How would you like that? He has to select the seven. I don't know that I have a good analogy for that, but it's sometimes when you talk to people who have been involved in combat or involved in some kind of military moment or police moment, and somebody who's a commander has to choose people for a certain assignment, he or she knows they likely aren't coming back. Who wants to be that person? Not me. David here has to select the people. He selects two sons of one of Saul's concubines, or a widow of Saul's, and five from what could be, or maybe is, his ex-wife. Doesn't that sound cheery? Why only two from Saul's widow? I don't know, but practically speaking, it's probably all who's left. Remember how many people died the day Saul lost his reign? There's not a lot of people left on his side. Then there's the controversy, non-controversy. I'm not worried about it. You probably shouldn't be either, in verses 7 through 10. Whereas this Michal, his ex-wife, or is this one of other Saul's other daughters? There could be an easy answer on this, that it's either Merib, Saul's daughter, or Michal, Saul's daughter. And before we say, well, wait a minute, if it says Michal, why would we even question it? Well, here's a few thoughts to consider. If it's Merib, who's mentioned in 1 Samuel 18 as one of Saul's daughter, she was given a marriage prior to David. Saul wanted to give her to David. She wanted to go to somebody else. He sent her to somebody else. Or it could be here, Michal. And if it is Michal, she had to have had another husband and kids with that other husband, but we don't have any scripture to show us that. But that wouldn't be too weird in their time, as men were usually short-lived compared to women. Nothing's changed here, I suppose. It could also be, and this would comment as well, if Merib had passed away and Michal had taken in and adopted any of Merib's sons, and they would be looked at as her sons, that was expected by the teachings of the law and required from God. My point is that is this. If you have a Bible that's a different translation in English, or you have footnotes, you'll see it say Merib, or you'll maybe see it say Michal. I'm not sure that it really matters in this sense. It's not better either way. Whether it's Merib or whether it's Michal, it's still Saul's daughter or it's David's former wife. If it's Michal, though, can you imagine how much more painful this has to be for her? You guys are familiar with the story of Michal or the accounts of Michal because of us going through it. And just to see what took place in her life with how her father treated her, how David treated her, and then how she chose to treat her own self and her responses to those choices. It's an ugly scenario. But then in the middle of all this ugliness, there's this weird moment. David spares Mephibosheth. He's making a seven, and then Jonathan's son, Mephibosheth, because there's another Mephibosheth in the account, he spares Mephibosheth. Now, it begs the question again, is David righteous or just to spare Mephibosheth? I think we can easily say yes for this reason. He's sparing Mephibosheth for exactly the same reason earlier that was given on why Saul should have spared the Gibeonites. He made a covenant to God with Jonathan to care for his lineage. And when he found Mephibosheth, what did he do? He took him in. He cared for him. He treated him as his own son. He never had to lack for anything. And so David says, I'm not going to violate what I said. That's recorded in 1 Samuel 20. I'm not going to violate that and end up right back in the same situation we're in right now because of what Joshua did and because of what Saul did, breaking what Joshua did. So I'm not going to be the cause again of that. In verses 9 and 10, they're delivered to the Gibeonites. I know I say this a lot, but I think it's important. Put yourself there. These men aren't curious where they're going. They know where they're going. Put yourself there with the goodbyes. It's not, hey, see you when you get back. There is no coming back from this. These are grown men. Are their wives involved? Are their kids involved? If they're old enough, are their great or their grandkids involved? They're not old enough to have great grandkids. Are their grandkids involved? I don't know. But the goodbyes are goodbye. They're final. There is closure there, and there's hurt. And they are going to go on this trip, and they're going to be walking with each other, and there's only one thing that's coming for them, and that is unavoidable death. Saul's widow is there. They are executed and hung up publicly. And Saul's widow is there grieving her sons. The killings take place at what the author records for kind of a timestamp at the beginning of the barley harvest. And this would be somewhere around maybe April or March from what we can tell there. And she is there in April and March with these bodies hanging out for public display as a lesson and a reminder. And she won't let anyone touch those corpses at all. She has her sackcloth likely to cover her from the sun glaring on her in the day. And she's going out and shooing the birds off her son's dead bodies there. And then at night, she's trying to ward off any kind of predator that may come. I mean, this is a tough mom. You know what I'm saying? And in her brokenness and in her grieving, as tragic as the scene is, as graphic as the scene is, as sad as the scene is, this mom is mourning the fact she can't bury her two sons. And every day and every night, she's there trying to make sure nothing picks any of the flesh that remains on her adult sons. Consequences always outlast us. This is an awful portion to read through. You may be different than me, but when I read this, when I think about this, I'm grieved for all those involved. Part of me fails to understand the political aspects involved here between two people groups who had a long-standing peace accord. I'm not there. I don't grasp it. I can see it in our culture, but is it a perfect parallel? I don't know. Part of me feels this way about it when I read it. Is this even just? I mean, how long ago had all this happened and it just now matters to God? I'm like, where'd the clock start and stop on this thing, God, right? This is pretty messed up in our minds. There's part of me who thinks this is a good fodder account for atheists. Why? Think about it. If you're an atheist, you could use this passage to twist and warp it and try to say that your all's God of the Bible demands human sacrifice. That's what he demanded. That's what he got after all. There's so many weird thoughts that go through my mind. Maybe not yours. But here's what part of me recognizes. Sin's consequences often reach so much further and so much farther in who they affect than what I want to believe mine ever will. Did everybody hear that? We read it here and we think, Saul, you knucklehead. But mine would never do that. I don't think my consequences are going to go further and farther than what I think I can contain the damage to, or it won't be that bad, or it'll never come to light, or I'll never get called on the carpet about it. Because all of us, in our self-justification, see our sins as less than others, and therefore the consequences should be diminished for us, or maybe God should just give us a little bop. We go on our way. But that's not what's happening in this passage, is it? Holy God said, you broke an oath. And now we're 3 years in a famine, for the whole nation, and we're seven people down because of Jonathan and the elders, and more so because of Saul and his decision with the Gibeonites. It should put a holy shiver down our spines to think about what we're capable of doing and who will experience the harm and the fallout from what we do. This is important for me and for you because we make so many decisions day in, day out. And as we make more and more decisions day in, day out, and as God gives us more years on this earth, there are more people in our sphere of influence. And we want to be very careful that in what we think are good or what we think are innocuous decisions, that they are just indeed that and not the groundwork for something much worse. Brothers and sisters, I think it's important we pause here and in our hearts, as I talk, ask the Holy Spirit to identify such motives and such choices in our own heart. Often we know that, but again, we kind of write it off as not as big of a deal as it seems to be. Or that somehow, we're kind of justified because of, and we fill in the blank. God didn't see it that way for them. And though we're not Israel, and though we're not in some peace accord with some enemy, etc., God is holy, consistently and constantly. Last point tonight is this. In the midst of what is just an ugly, messy scenario, David shows grace on grace in how he treated former enemies and how he treats the grieving as well. The situation is not ideal for anyone, particularly him as a king, having to take accountability for that which he did not do, the disobedience of previous generations. But if that's not enough to cause him grief and heaviness, I want you to consider what he hears in verse number 11. Look at verse number 11 again and see what he says. And it was told David what Rizpah had done. So if it's not enough to have 3 years and have to go to God about, and if it's not enough to get the answer, this is because Saul, what he did to the Gibeonites, if it's not enough to say, hey, yeah, we really don't want anything, well, we'll take seven, and you get to choose them. Ooh. And David had to have that happen. Now, he hears there's this mom out there grieving and mourning her adult sons, how she's doing it day and night. I want you to understand how long she's been doing this. Check out verse number 11 there. He hears about it. Verse number 12, he takes the bones down. And you go on and read, and you realize that she's been down there. It says, until the rain fell. I want you to understand, this idea, as one author put it, till the rain fell, it gives us the time, reference or a timestamp for her vigil for her sons. Following harvest, there's dry weather in Israel until, guess what, September or October. How long's mom been doing this? Since likely March or April? And now we're to the fall. Every day out there, well, how'd she sustain herself? I don't know. How'd she eat and drink every day? I don't know. But in some way, she mourned her sons in person for 6 months. That's not only unhealthy, it's unheard of, isn't it? She's out there every single day keeping watch over those bones at that part, probably by that point. And before we discuss what David did, and how he did it, consider what he could have done. If he was like his predecessor, what would he have done, or what could he have done when he gets the news of this grieving mom and what she's doing? A constant reminder to the people of what David had to do in choosing the seven. Well, he could have left her to continue mourning. It's not his problem, after all. He could have asked for the Gibeonites to take care of it and trust they'll treat her in a decent manner, perhaps, but they don't have a reason to. He could have sent soldiers to provoke her, to make her make a decision that they could find cause to do what they seem to see as necessary. Or he could have sent just an ugly message via emissary reminding her, hey, guess what? Deal with it. Consequences, consequences, consequences. But verses 11 through 14, that's not what we find. We find David's plan extended grace to his former foe,
showed his love and grace that he wanted for his best friend, and shows grace to this grieving mom mourning month after month. We'll summarize 12 through 14 quickly to say this. David does what? He collects Saul's bones from the men of Jabesh-Gilead. Remember them? They had gone in 1 Samuel 31 when they heard about Saul and his sons being strung up at Beth-Shan. And they go into this military stronghold of the Philistines and they take back those bodies and they bury their bones somewhere else. He goes and collects their bones. He goes and gathers then the executed men there from the Gibeonites. You can see it on the map there. And so David goes up north to Jabesh-Gilead, he goes over to Gibeah, and he grabs those bones, and then he goes south there to Jerusalem. David goes on an unnecessary journey. God didn't tell him to. God's not forcing him to. God's not making him do it. But out of his kindness, out of unmerited favor, he decides, I'll collect all the bones, and I'll take them to Saul's dad's burial site. And the family will be buried together with honor and dignity. And David gives what Saul could never have earned or deserved based on how he treated David. And what he wasn't able to give his great friend Jonathan. And what these men didn't deserve maybe because of Saul's choices. These seven men. He takes all of them and treats them with dignity and with honor. Consider that each of those steps meant what? Planning transportation. Allocating people from the kingdom to take care of it, and using resources to care for the matter that he had not created at all. It seems the choices of David, both righteous and unrighteous, had taught him something important for this moment, which was what? Be gracious in such situations. I want us to be clear because these words get tossed about too much in Christendom and perverted in their definition. When we talk about David being gracious, it doesn't mean freeing anyone from their consequences, lest truth fall by the wayside. It did mean seeking a resolution which showed kindness with truth. It was both grace and truth. Now, this is a tough consideration for you and I at this intersection or this crossroads. How do we treat those who've wronged us? How do we handle situations that require us to deal with a mess someone else has created? We can't be cowardly and not seek what's true for or right, nor can we be harsh, exacting as much judgment as possible. God calls us to be what? People of grace and people of truth. You see, grace and truth are what are needed to accomplish anything for God in a matter. Jesus came, and what was he? Full of grace and truth. What did Paul tell the Ephesian church that were the elements of edification? Speaking the truth in love, a graciousness about it. You need and have to have both. How does God respond to this approach from David? The end of verse 14 is poignant for us to consider. It says here, God was entreated on behalf of the nation and the land. The idea of being entreated is this. It gives a sense of there were prayers going up from Israel to him, begging for his intervention, and based on the choices of David to rectify what had been wronged to make it right, God hears the prayers, and harmony is reestablished between the covenant nation and their covenant-keeping God. Their actions put down the drawbridge for them. It leaves us with a hard question. Why did God deal with this when he did? Why did he deal with it how he did? Why did he let it go unreconciled for so long and then have it reconciled the way he allowed it to be reconciled? Why would grown men have to atone for the sins of their father? I don't know if we can answer all those perfectly, but let's work through a few thoughts real quick. What we should note is that integrity in these matters is what God cared about for the covenant people. He cared about what those in positions of authority did and said and acted out. He cared about justice. He cared about reconciliation. He cared enough about all of it to do what? To invoke a nationwide famine to afflict everyone if it meant holiness would be the result for his covenant people. That is hard for me to wrap my mind around, that the kids for 3 years struggled to have food on their tables because of something Saul did in the past But God was concerned more than just meals for the little kids. He was concerned about their entire nation being and becoming what he intended them to be, as a lighthouse for him to the unsaved world around. Though this is an unusual passage for us as Westerners to identify with, due to the politics involved of their day, combined with the covenant promises of the nation of Israel, combined with also the law's requirements, hopefully it makes us do what? Pause and consider what took place in this account with David and the nation. It leaves us three questions for us to walk away with. Where do I turn when I'm in a jam? David, when it became evident to him that this is not just natural curse of sin on us, what is going on is just normal stuff, that it was clear there was a problem and he had an issue, David's first response was to go to God rather than try to fill in the blanks or fill in the gap with a temporal-based solution. So it makes us beg the question, how do I handle jams in my life, particularly when they are messes that I didn't create, that weren't of my fault, as it were, or my doing? David seeks what's righteous rather than what's convenient. How aware are we about our choices and how they impact those who will outlive us? I suspect if I could take a microphone and for 10 minutes walk around to some of the older brothers and sisters in the room, I bet you they would speak to this truth and have more insights than the younger brothers and sisters in the room. What do you mean, Pastor? They have grown in their awareness that their choices impact more than just them. In good ways, yes. In consequential ways that are unfavorable, yes. There's a reason James 1, 13 through 15 is still in the book. What does it say? Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth any man. But every man or woman is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, it brings forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, brings forth death. The consequences always affect us and more. Even when you don't have to, can you still be gracious to those who have caused you harm? In the workplace or where you go to school, we encounter occasions of mistreatment and injustice regularly. Some of you no doubt have stories of being in the workforce and having a boss do something to undermine you or paint you in a negative or fictitious or false light. You've had coworkers do something immoral or indecent to get around or get ahead or get a position or do something to make sure you were stunted or caused grief. At the school place, you've had other students do something to get you in trouble, do something to harm you, do something to mistreat you online. You've had coaches sit you down for something you didn't agree with. Parents, you've had your kids sat down for something you didn't agree with from a teacher, from a coach. There are times when people will do something legitimately to discourage or harm you. Now, let's be careful here. A lot of that's perception, isn't it? Well, my little Johnny, he would score 37 points in that basketball game if coach would put him in. Hey, Johnny can't even figure out how to tie his shoes. Your coach is not making him a martyr, okay? There's perceptions. But then there are legitimate occasions, aren't there? We have to ask ourselves what we're doing with those moments. Am I asking and receiving the help of God Almighty to deal with a mess, maybe not even of my own doing, to do what God would want in that moment? Even if it doesn't further my career, further my relationship, further my financial net worth, further, am I willing to be gracious and act on truth, even towards those who cause me harm? You see, my friends, tonight, no matter how difficult the situation has become due to other people's choices, God is still calling me, he's still calling you back to a difficult choice to make, which is what? I'm going to be gracious with God's help. I'm going to be truthful with God's help. I'm just going to forge a way forward. Doesn't mean things are going to be great, enjoyable, or perfect, or right on this realm. But I can trust God. David had to trust God with his entire weird scenario, and God responded. I'd call us to the same idea or same mindset. I'm going to do right. I'm going to do right in a gracious manner. I'm going to pray, and then I want to give you a moment. Because maybe there's something or someone in your life. In the past, it's come up. It's in the present facing you. It's something you see on the horizon that's forming. And you just think, I don't want this, or this isn't fair, or I shouldn't have to face this, or thanks a lot, fill in the blank, or God, where are you right now in all this mess? And I just remind us, God's calling us to graciousness and truth, and we can do the right thing with his help. So I'm going to pray, and we'll have a little moment of music. I just want you to take a moment and consider where you're at with God and what's taking place in your life. Father, I pray that you'd help me, help my brothers and sisters here as well. With so many moving parts in this passage that seem maybe foreign or odd to us, but people are still people. And the principles displayed here are still taking place around us. So God, I ask that you'd help me and my brothers and sisters follow David's example here, as Paul told the Corinthians to do, that we would inquire of you when we have in conflict and solution, in issues and need solutions. May we be cautioned by what Joshua and the elders did, but then more so what Saul decided to do and what it cost those beyond him in his time. And then, Lord, help us with these scenarios. Rather than focus on the issues and the problems, which are real, instead of assigning it to all the people who are causing it, and maybe they have, may we ask for your help to be people who are truthful, but people who are gracious. Lord, I pray you help each of us tonight, in our families, in our marriages, in our church relationships, in our school relationships, our work relationships, and beyond, Lord, the areas that we need your help. In Christ's name, amen. I want to give you a moment just with our heads bowed to consider what we've heard. Maybe the Lord stirred something in your life, or maybe you have a scenario right now that fits this in many ways, that we just submit to God and what he wants to do and what he's calling or stirring in our thoughts right now.